You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
We're very privileged to have as our guest Dr. Martha Eckelsberg. Martha Eckelsberg comes from a very progressive family. She was born in New York City to a socialist Zionist parents, so politics was always part of the daily conversations. Her work has included teaching political theory, urban politics, political activism, and feminist theory. Her book, Resistant Citizenship, was just released in October of 2009, and we're very privileged to have her on our show today. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
Now, it's been 100 years since Women's International Day was established in Copenhagen, and to date, we are seeing still a struggle for women to reach pay equity. You know, happily, the European Union has just decided for the first time to bring women's pay in line with men. In Europe, women right now earn 82 cents to every dollar men earns in Europe. In Canada, that figure is more like 70 cents to every dollar. Mm-hmm. You call this book Resistant Citizenship, and you explore the depoliticization of economic life in the United States over the last 200 years. Why is this significant, and in particularly, why is this important for us to understand in the context of the struggle of women's equality?
I call the book Resisting Citizenship because I think the term citizenship has been drawn on a lot by progressives over the course of the last 20 years in particular. I think after the fall of the Soviet Union, people are looking for some way to talk about equity. Citizenship has the connotation of participation, of engagement, and that's really important. But citizenship also excludes as much as it includes, because citizenship tends to be structured around nation states, and nation states defined who is in and who is out. Being in entails different kinds of privileges, obviously privileges and rights and obligations. So I wanted to put to the forefront some of the problems with using citizenship as a major way to talk about the issues that we're trying to address, issues of equity and justice and inclusion. I don't exactly have a better word for it, but I think citizenship has some problematic connotations, let's just put it that way. You know, which we certainly see in the United States at the moment and in Europe and in many other places in all of these struggles around immigration. Who's going to be in, who's going to be out? What does it mean to be a citizen as opposed to somebody who's a kind of a resident alien, if that? So that's why I chose the title.
In terms of participation, though, because I think the whole issue of exclusion, and I think you alluded to the same issue with the term community, you know, a community of whom? Who's invited to participate? Mm-hmm. So what would it mean for women to have full participatory status within a society?
Well, I think it would mean a lot changing. For a society to allow everybody to be fully participatory would mean that all the work of enabling the society to function would have to be more equitably shared. I just was giving a talk a couple of weeks ago and said that one of the people that we turn to as a theorist of citizenship is Aristotle, who talked about everybody should have a turn in ruling and being ruled in turn, and it was a very participatory notion of citizenship. But what made that possible was a whole chunk of the population, which was, you know, in numbers probably way more than those people who are citizens, whom he called necessary conditions. Who do the work that makes possible what everybody else does when they're engaging in the activities of citizenship. And most societies that we know of, that work of caring for children, caring for families, caring for elders, is done by women. And if that work is not equitably shared, there's no way that the work of citizenship and engagement and political participation is going to be able to be equitably shared either. So what we're talking about is really profound changes in how we understand the roles that people play in society, the way we've structured support, the way we've structured our understandings of politics, the way we've structured our understandings of whose business it is to do the work of supporting and sustaining not just politicians, but families, workers, even when women themselves are workers. They do still the overwhelming majority of the work of maintaining their families and communities.
And that's an important point. I was interviewing a leader from Bolivia, and Marcelo Saavedra was telling us about how the principle of democracy, he says that a participatory democracy needs to have economic elements in place to really make it salient to that population. In Bolivia, for instance, they're now just instituted a new constitution that not only asserts the rights of women and men as equals, but also the rights of nature. And in contrast, in our society, we have a society that treats women as a minority. In Canada, we are, you know, decades from a struggle to achieve daycare services, a struggle that means instead of achieving some of those gains, we're actually in a backward motion where services mm-hmm. are being cut. And here I come back to your book. You talk about this depoliticization of economic life in the United States, but I think this applies to us as well, where there's been a split between the economics and politics in the American political mm-hmm. consciousness. What has this cost us in terms of making the connections to the political economy of how that is organized? What are we losing?
I think it's cost us enormously, because splitting economics from politics and, in a way, making believe that because we all have technically equal rights to participate, we are therefore equal in the political arena, does a number of things. It takes attention from economic inequality out of the domain of politics to a considerable degree. I mean, that's probably more true in the United States than it is in Canada, but, you know, in the U.S., I think our favorite example of the depoliticization was the response of President George W. Bush after 9/11, and he told people they should go out and shop. That citizenship, now one way in which on a national level we talk about citizenship is in the strength of the economy and building up economic power and might, which is not by any stretch of the imagination democratic or equitably distributed within the United States. Our levels of income and wealth inequality are greater now than they have been in many, many years. And those are effectively taken out of the realm of politics. That's not anything that democratic politics even talks about now, which was not presumably what was the case, you know, in the early years of at least the American Republic, the U.S. Republic. But I think the other thing that it does is it treats as individual problems all of those things that prevent not just women, but any group that's relatively marginalized economically from full political participation. Because those things that are barriers, you know, which are rooted in economic inequality, can't really be talked about. And they're considered to be irrelevant to political participation, so therefore people who, for a variety of reasons, are not as active politically get blamed for inattention to their concerns in the political arena, as if, you know, simply voting is really going to make a difference in terms of the way the economy is structured here, which is clearly not the case.
That's such an important point. As you were speaking, I was reminded of the recent crisis in Greece, where a very prominent singer came out and said, you know, let's all come together for the country and save the country. I'm forgoing my pension and I'm calling on everybody to do the same, you know, to just
I think
of that tone of patriotism and nationalism that sometimes unites us. the importance of that narrative, right? That implies that we're all in this together. But, you know, in 2004, when they spent over $11 billion in the Olympics in Greece, the majority of the population didn't participate. You know,
that's right.
Similar to BC. So, you know, this it's important to connect that. I wanted, if you could talk a little bit more about this impact, and particularly in how these policies of depoliticization has enabled a neoliberalism model of capitalism to really take root. And we are seeing, you know, rapid growth of privatization in all public sectors. Things that used to be in the public realm are disappearing. Mm-hmm. Why is this so important to protect?
Well, it's important to protect because the so-called free market economy, which is not, as we know, free market anyway, does really not take care of questions of equity and justice. There are many things that are needs, whether they're for clean water, clean air, decent education, health care, supports in times of illness or old age, that cannot, or I guess I would say should not, be distributed by the market. They're not, those are not things which, as members of a democratic political community that's supposed to be concerned with the needs of its members, that those things should not be distributed according to people's ability to pay. You know, I think when democratic governments are founded, as my students recently were writing, you know, they said, well, governments are supposed to be committed to taking care of their people. But when you privatize all of these things, then everyone is subject to the vagaries of the market, and the market means those who have economic power get more of whatever it is they want, and those people who have no economic power get almost nothing. And when you have things that are basic needs for life, you don't want those things distributed through the market. You know, I think one of the things that we're seeing in places like the United States, Canada, and even Western Europe is that the kinds of policies that have been imposed by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on developing countries as conditionalities of the loans that they receive, these so-called economic restructuring plans that forced many countries in Latin America, Africa, and Asia to privatize their public sectors, make them more like Western Europe and North America, they're now, in some ways, those policies are coming home to roost here as well. And they're not good for anybody.
So how do we resist? How do we, as women, take back our labor? Or, you know, what forms of resistance do we then engage that we can be successful in? Because I think that's the part, right? No one wants to be take up a struggle that they feel is not going to succeed, you know? So what alternatives do we have, and where do we find common ground with others?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I say in the book is that I think one of the things that makes it difficult is that there's an enormous amount of this kind of work going on, people organizing at the local level to either protest toxic dumping or try to improve the quality of their schools or whatever it is they're doing. They're not just protesting. They are also, you know, as was going on in the 60s and 70s, creating alternative institutions. But there's a kind of fragmentation of knowledge that's partly, I think, in part a consequence of the tremendous diversity of the media. You know, when I think back to kind of anti-Vietnam War organizing or the civil rights movement in the United States or the anti-war movement in the 1950s and 1960s, we had three major television networks. People watched the news at night, and they knew what was going on. Now we have many, many, many different sources of information. There is very little common information. People tend to watch or listen to the sources that they like and completely ignore everything else. So it's very difficult to get a sense of being part of a larger movement. That was you know, that gets broken on occasion, like the WTO meetings in Seattle in 1999 or 2000, you know, moments of response to crisis, like in Haiti or Hurricane Katrina or now in Chile. So I think somehow or another we need to rebuild or reconstitute or create anew some mechanisms for communicating to one another what's actually happening in many, many different places around the world and around our various countries, where people, women, relatively marginalized people are engaging, they're acting, they are creating new situations, or at least challenging the old ones. But it's that sense of isolation and not knowing that anybody else is part of doing the same kinds of things that's very disempowering.
I was thinking about the military coup in Honduras, and as we were interviewing people in Honduras, one of the women said, you know, it's important for us that we denounce the military coup. It's important for us that the international community sees that this is an illegal act, that this should not be happening mm-hmm. in the 21st century. But she says, ultimately, it's about changing the system, a system that has not enabled us to participate in it. She says, so for the women in Honduras, and I always talk to my friends and say, well, I have no time and I'm too busy. And I think, you know, how can, and I guess in so many ways that is true, right? We're running the clock. We're doing all kinds of things. But at the same time, are we really investing in what ought to be a priority? In your book, you call for us a reconquering of the public sphere, you know, retaking the public space. And I think that can take many forms. What would you say to people who say, well, I have no time, I'm too busy, I do too many other things that I don't have time to participate politically?
I think we don't have time not to. You know, sometimes people define political participation in very narrow terms. I think, you know, I would define political participation as any engagement with issues of concern to the public good, which includes, you know, all of our lives. And if we don't have time for that, I don't think we have time for anything. We can't. We have to make time for that, I guess, is what I would say, because when we leave that to others, then those who are powerful continue to build on their power, and those who are relatively less powerful find their power disappearing. I mean, I think one of the other things, and, you know, it's sort of your mention of Honduras reminded me, I mean, I think it's one of the things that International Women's Day was named International Women's Day, in part to highlight the importance of cross-national communications, alliances, coalitions, mutual support. You know, if you think about, let's say, the Madres de Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, those were women who said, we don't have time not to be engaged in trying to figure out what happened to our children or our husbands or our brothers or our sons or our daughters. We have to do this. And it was in part international support that enabled them to continue their protests and eventually be successful as part of a coalition of people that brought down the dictatorship. So I think the other thing that we need to be reminded of in so many different situations is that it's precisely that sense of isolation and powerlessness and I'm in this by myself or we're in this by ourselves that is what contributes to a further disempowerment and depoliticization. And we need to remember that there are people elsewhere in our various countries and elsewhere in the world who are engaged in these same struggles. And somehow or another, we now have capacity for of a sort that we didn't used to have, and maybe we can use that to learn more from one another and support one another.
That's wonderful. For people who want to learn more about your book, how do they get access to Resistant Citizenship? The book was just released, so how can people get a hold of it?
It's published by Routledge. I suppose they can ask their bookstores for it, or it's also available, I guess, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you get books, you can ask for it.
Wonderful. Now, in parting, how do you keep yourself inspired? What inspires you to keep struggling in spite of setbacks, or, you know, what makes you do what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, what enables me to keep doing this is the stories of the people, mostly women that I've spoken to, who have continued under circumstances and conditions that are way more difficult than anything I have confronted. When I was in Argentina, for example, almost 20 years ago, and met the mother, you know, some of the madres, and they were talking about what they had been through and what they had suffered, and their children had been disappeared, and they were out there day after day, and, you know, they said, we don't have a choice. And, you know, there are many, many people who are struggling in cities and towns in the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, you know, all around the world, recognizing that they don't have a choice. And I think, in part, those of us who feel like we do have a choice need to use the privileges we have to support those who have fewer choices, and in fact whose choices have been constrained by our governments that have given us this feeling of having more choices. So we are living, in a sense, off, maybe not quite so directly, but the comfortable lives that we are living, even those of us who are not living such comfortable lives, are in many ways dependent on the constraints that are operating on people elsewhere in the world. And I sort of feel like once one becomes aware of that, we really don't have a choice.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Hahn, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.